Welcome, everybody, to the TLS panel discussion. We actually go from now all the way through to the break, so this session ends at 10:30. After speaking with the panel participants, I'm actually moderating the panel. We're hoping for a very interactive session. We do have some pre-prepared slides. If we get through the slides, we will have a sense of a failed panel. This is really meant to be interactive with the audience participation all the way through. I'm not going to read out everybody's bio. I'm going to let each of the panel members introduce themselves. So starting from this side, we have Rich Soles. David, of course, has sat out of order, so David Hook. So Rich on this end, representing OpenSSL. David Hook representing the Legion of the Bouncy Castle. And Brent Cook representing OpenBSD. So first off, how about you introduce yourselves briefly?
Sure. Rich Soles, work on OpenSSL. My day job is Akamai, and I'm on the OpenSSL Management Committee. Good enough.
Hi.
I'm Brent Cook. I work on OpenBSD and LibreSSL. My day job, I work at Rapid7, a security company, and I work on offensive security tools, Metasploit being one of the most famous ones. So.
David Hook, the Bouncy Castle cryptography APIs. My day job, I actually work for a company called Crypto Workshop, whose job is to work on the Bouncy Castle APIs. So I guess you could say I'm living the dream. I'm not quite sure, though. Yes, thank you.
So David, is panel participation part of living the dream?
Well, as I said, I'm not quite sure.
So what I've done is, as usual, it sort of takes a little while to get audience participation up and going. I've got a dummy question to ask the three panel members, which I will just flip across to. How many TLS implementations are there? Have we got enough? Have we got too many? How do they come and go? What's the life cycle of an implementation? And is this good or bad? Do we need more? Do we need fewer? David, your views on this.
Do we need more or do we need fewer?
Would you like the next slide up?
Yeah, I think that would help because that actually says how many implementations are. I don't have Wikipedia on my phone. So there are quite a few, and in a variety of languages. I think this is one of those cases where more is probably better. The reason for that is there's always ambiguities in the spec, and the only way that you can really sort those out is by different people interpreting them different ways, and that often shows up. Sometimes it actually shows up security flaws, because if you read it in one particular way as opposed to another, you might end up doing something inconvenient, is what I'd say. And it's when you get incompatibilities under those circumstances that people kind of iterate down to a more sensible approach. That would be my feeling on that.
Yeah, I agree. I think more is also better, but maybe for different reasons. One particular reason is, different projects have different goals. Maybe security is your goal. Maybe speed is your goal. Maybe size, different sorts of things. And so optimizing for any whatever parameter you're looking for is obviously one thing that motivates someone to build an implementation. Other things are come to security in general. I think that if you consider the plight of the simple banana, right? Kind of the single gene, single plant, one disease comes in, wipes out the entire, the industry. And it's actually happened a few times. Same thing with regards to software ecosystems. The more wide and diverse it is, the less likely that a single bug can actually have catastrophic effects across an entire industry or basically an entire software ecosystem. So I think having more implementations and more testing, more people that are involved in it can only be a good thing.
Okay, just because people expect me to say it, there should be only one, it should be OpenSSL. no, I don't really believe that. I think others have pointed out, it used to be in the IETF that the definition of interoperable was not what the standard said, but it was what OpenSSL implemented, which meant things like bug-for-bug compatibility, and that's not good for the country, good for the world, like the community. And having multiple interoperable implementations is good. Also, it actually reduces the pressure on some implementations to conform for every single need. OpenSSL is never going to be small enough to fit in somebody's smart light bulb. There are other offerings to do that, either commercial or open source. So it helps. I'm glad to see over time the two major forks are diverging more so that we don't see the same defects in all implementations. So at some point we'll probably get too many, but I think the marketplace will filter out the ones that don't deserve to survive.
So you'd see this list up here as a reasonable size indication of a healthy ecosystem?
I'd argue that the list is probably a lot larger than that, mostly because everybody's got a fork, and everyone's got their own fixes. As one of the speakers spoke yesterday, like China, a lot of Chinese developers are hesitant to contribute bug fixes back or even know how to do it. And I know 10 years ago I was working with OpenSSL, and just to continue my thought, and it seemed like everyone you talked to had their own fork, their own tweaks, their own ways that they kind of use as an advantage.
Oh, absolutely. Forks are good. And thanks, Paul, for coming up for the first question.
It's not actually a question. When I did a review about 2 years ago, we got to 38 toolkits, and I know we missed some. So there's a huge number of embedded toolkits that just aren't represented on that list.
So you don't believe in updating Wikipedia as the ultimate source of truth?
You can sit down.
How do I answer that? No.
And in your view, Paul, while you're at the mic, your view on the diversity of implementations, good thing, bad thing?
I think the diversity is a good thing for the reasons mentioned. You know, a diverse ecosystem is a safer ecosystem. It's more resilient.
Any other thoughts, topics, questions? We've got three folks up here on a panel. We're meant to give them some difficult questions so it becomes a little more entertaining. And feel free to stack the questions.
So there's a diversity of crypto implementations, but what does it translate in terms of products that implement it? Because in the end, it is, you know, you have a variety of tools, but are they being used, or is it all using OpenSSL or maybe two or three crypto implementations?
I'm sure each panel member will have a response to that. Does anybody actually use what you work on?
I don't think anyone uses OpenSSL, right? Actually,
yeah. Almost everybody. So if you discount the two browsers, then everything else uses OpenSSL, right? Or maybe this little this Apple platform that has gone with Libre. There's a lot of the same implementations of crypto, and I think that's an interesting point. The OpenSSL stuff has had issues, has had some bugs. It's impenetrable, but we have this one mad expat Russian who codes assembler like nobody's business, right? So that gets picked up a lot. I think it's important to distinguish crypto implementations from, say, protocol implementations from, say, ASN1 X509. That last one is such a tar pit. Amazon says, oh, look, we have a great, nothing against S2N. It's got some really cool features, but they put all the grotty parts over by just using OpenSSL's ASN1 crypto library. So, yeah.
David, you got some views on that?
Yeah, so actually, yeah, people definitely use what we're doing because we get the emails. It's the best way to tell often.
Emails thanking you for your efforts or emails complaining?
Eventually. The other thing we do find, though, is because the way that Java Virtual Machine was originally licensed, it was to a variety of platform sizes. We do have a lot of people that actually subset what we provide, going back to the discussion earlier about the fact that, yeah, there's a lot of implementations that we never see. And we're aware of the fact that there's quite a lot of implementations based on both the Bouncy Castle implementations that are actually subsetted for devices, quite specifically. Which we never hear about except when people find compatibility issues.
We have a few different kind of target markets. Sorry, I hate to say markets. We don't have a market per se, but big users that I kind of see as part of LibreSSL. Obviously, operating system integration is interesting and important. We have a couple Linux distributions that use us as the base. Alpine Linux being one of the kind of the more famous ones, a security-oriented distro. Obviously, OS X packages, but they also package a super old version, which kind of makes them feel a little obsolete and a little bit irrelevant from my point of view. Yeah, and like a 4-year-old version. So I don't know.
So they went from OpenSSL 0.98 to a 4-year-old version of Libre?
That's right. Yeah.
Wow.
Actually, it's maybe 2 years old, but still annoyingly enough old that it's like, well, what do we do with this?
I share your
pain. Yeah. So, yeah, we get the bug reports, but yeah. It's like, we fix that. Other things is we actually have quite a few people in DevOps that actually embed LibreSSL, not necessarily at the OS level, but like, say, I just statically built it in Nginx, and this is how I deploy my application infrastructure, or I'm running a big web app, and it's built in like that. I also get a ton of requests and input from Windows users, which I find really interesting. Even though it's sort of embedded in OpenBSD and it's part of that ecosystem, a lot of people really want that OpenSSL.exe. That's actually, I've had a lot of people say, please build me OpenSSL.exe. That's like the one thing I need. So it's a kind of an interesting need that I didn't realize would be out there. Effectively, we have this discussion every 6 months. Are people using it? Is software uptaking it? And if it's not, you know, that's kind of when we rethink, like, what are we doing? Are we making it better, or are we making the ecosystem worse if people aren't using it?
So before we get to Bob's question, we have a really interesting problem is, yeah, we don't know who's using it. And like, well, can we turn off this feature? Maybe, maybe not. And I'm just wondering what you guys do.
Yeah, we're very careful about turning stuff off because our experience has been inevitably that somebody somewhere is using it. Even if it's something really obscure. Okay, and in fact, it's one of the difficulties with this because we've been trying to get more and more rigorous about the way we do things because a lot of the sort of attacks and vulnerabilities appear around the edge, protocols like SSL. And yeah, the issue is, you know, you fix something, think you're doing the right thing, and then you do the release, and then a couple of weeks later, you start getting emails going, but, and you feel bad, even if you've done the right thing. So normally these days, actually, when we're turning stuff off, we try and, we'll disable first, go for a couple of releases, see if anyone notices, try and get the people who have noticed to work around it, and then we'll actually remove the feature permanently.
So what sort of time period does the deprecation removal cycle go over, David?
Probably about a year and a half.
About a year and a half.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good to know.
That's fast.
That is very fast. Bob, you've got a question?
I have a comment. I was just going to push back a little bit on the diversity of SSL implementations. I think there's also the point where we have too many. The things I think about is, one, if somebody is trying to implement something, your first step should not be to go implement SSL, go use one of the existing libraries. Two, even though there's lots of libraries out there, there's really only should be a couple of them that we care about from industry point of view. One of the issues we run into is every time we get a major release, like our next release of RHEL is being worked on right now, and as we're pulling the input in from Fedora, we're pulling in all these crypto libraries, and we're like, no, because every one of those needs to be validated, FIPS validation. So there's a cost to having those in. And the third thing, as an ecosystem, we don't want so many that we can't put the effort we need into the ones that are out there. So the ones that we're actually using and depending on. So for instance, right after Heartbleed, there is this knee-jerk reaction that says, oh, we need to fork OpenSSL so that we don't have another Heartbleed. Well, we have a Heartbleed because we need enough eyes on the stuff going in. Forking that particular project splits the people's focus, and so I think, yes, it's good to have a lot of different implementations out there, and I think the natural naturally will work out. But we also, you also have the ones that we really care about that we're going to make sure we have enough effort behind them in order to keep them in. So, you know, if we're taking focus away from GNU TLS and OpenSSL and NSS, then we have too many of them.
Thanks, Bob. That's sort of a viewpoint, I think, that's based on the available pool of developer resources that are interested in TLS implementations is finite.
Yeah.
Any panel members want to comment on Bob's view on that?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Yeah. I would say I wouldn't have probably contributed to OpenSSL at all if there hadn't been a LibreSSL fork, to be honest with you. While I, you know, had worked on it from a commercial point of view, as far as embedding into products, forks that were internal to things, there was less of an incentive at that point to do it because, you know, obviously you make an improvement, you optimize for some piece of hardware, something like that. It's just a very commercial mindset. But when it came to you know, the things that are LibreSSL's goals, I believe those are still somewhat divergent from OpenSSL's goals. Like say, FIPS compliance is not important to us and not something that we're actually going to be addressing. It might be kind of unpopular with this audience. It seems like FIPS is kind of a big focus here. I mean, maybe that's an understatement of the year, but basically that's what I've kind of observed over the course of the conference. And it's just not something we're even thinking about, not something we even care about. For instance, that particular goal is sort of, you know, that's at odds. Understanding, I don't know if you guys saw my talk yesterday, but I talked basically how a lot of the things that we do improvements on LibreSSL aren't just about focusing on the library, but about focusing on fixing the whole ecosystem. So we have over 6,000 ports where we look through the code and we find out where people are misusing APIs. When we implement a new API in LibreSSL, we find where people are doing it wrong. And we upstream that stuff too. So we're not just fixing our library, we're fixing the whole ecosystem. When we find interfaces inside of operating systems that are wrong, that are being worked around in libraries, whether it's the malloc-free function, which, for instance, if OpenSSL hadn't wrapped the memory allocator, OpenBSD would have caught the Heartbleed bug faster. So basically trusting the operating system and moving the operating system technology forward has been something that's also been one of our goals, which is probably also a little bit at odds to like some of the other goals of the other projects. So I think having that different mindset, it's not just about one particular bug. I think that's kind of missing the point. I think it's more about driving an entire ecosystem forward. And I think having different mindsets, for instance, around, like, say, an operating system versus just a library or a module, I think that kind of gives you a different focus. And I don't really think it splits the effort because, effectively, the developers that work on OpenBSD are still the same developers that worked on OpenBSD. We have maybe four or five external developers, I think, that regularly contribute, but that's about it.
So, David, do you find a whole pile of operating systems hit you in the Java and C Sharp world?
Not really. What I would say is that it'd be kind of interesting if the slide back there actually identified the origins of the actual implementation. Because in some ways, if I was to think about it, and this would apply to OpenSSL as much as it applies to us, There's certainly Java and C-sharp implementations of TLS that are basically based on data mining. It's not so much that people have gone, I want to implement TLS from scratch. It's more they've gone, I want TLS, but I only want a couple of cipher suites and I want a restricted range of extensions to be available. And so then they've taken our API and they've shrunk it down and they've chopped it up like they need to and then they've used it for that. In some ways, that's kind of helpful because that can be a source of people finding errors. And the reason for that, of course, is that it narrows the scope of the code they're actually looking at. So people I find in general are more likely to notice errors if the code is smaller and simpler. And so in that process of reducing the code, they do tend to notice errors, which hopefully they feed back to us. I think that's the only thing I'd add is we probably need to find better ways of encouraging people who are forking off existing distributions to feed the errors back. I think that would definitely make for a healthier ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. So along those lines, are we thinking that we should have a single cipher suite? rather than a whole range of them is less better, or is the diversity of things like cipher suites actually a good thing?
I would say less is better, to be honest with you. In that particular case, I would argue less is better.
Where less is one?
No. It's hard to say. I don't think so. Yeah. I think there needs to be at least two.
And which ones would they be?
I don't know. The one that works and the one that works better.
Did you want
to... to that point, actually, I think that there are probably a number of cipher suites that should be deprecated and or removed with extreme prejudice because they are past due as far as how easy they are to subvert. Mm-hmm. But to another question, in TLS implementations, we've also got the range of do they actually do 1.1 or 1.2 or about to do 1.3, or are they stuck back at 1.0? And so do they really interoperate properly, and how do you know that they actually interoperate correctly? And how often in the TLS universe are we doing bake-offs to see whether they're using a smaller subset of ciphers? Would be part of an interesting question. Do we actually have any kind of event that's going on that I wouldn't necessarily know about that is comparing and contrasting the subsetted implementations?
So to that point, for the panel members, I've just put up the TLS 1.3 draft level support slide behind you.
I would say no, we don't, at least among these, at least from my point of view, we have one way to do it with LibreSSL. Go ahead.
So the IETF has, the IETF's group has ongoing interop stuff, mm-hmm. and it tends to be people who are, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, although they don't say anything public, right? As is typical, and OpenSSL. There was a Haskell implementation, the wiki page there. So there's a lot of interop going on for TLS 1.3 during the iterations through all the drafts. And one of the technically one reason why that was interesting and doable was because each draft put a specific value in the protocol identifier. So it wasn't just you did TLS 1.3, there was an extension that said TLS 1.3 draft 18. So if you mm-hmm. talk to somebody who was on TLS draft 19, it would fail to negotiate 1.3 and it would fall back to 1.2. So you could deploy it on the general internet and it would work normally for the normal sites, but for those that were, cutting edge or testing and so on, you'd be able to test interop. You were able in particular to test over on the public internet going through middle boxes. Which had a big impact. One of the reasons 1.3 was delayed by a month, 2 months, was because there were middle boxes that were intolerant to the TLS version. So what we did is tweak the protocol to make it look like TLS 1.2. It worked, and so the middle boxes said, oh, it's TLS 1.2. Being able to do those kind of tests where you can do clean fallback while the protocol is being developed, it was incredibly useful. It made it incredibly deployable. During my talk yesterday, I mentioned Akamai put TLS 1.3 out as an open beta, and we have maybe a couple hundred customers signed up to use it now. We don't know how many people are actually using it because not a single customer complained. Which is pretty amazing. No one said, "Oh, my traffic went down. You DOSed me." So that's being able to do live testing. Live testing on the internet is not something that existed 3 years ago, right? You maybe did A/B
testing.
Not
as easily, yes.
Not easily.
Right. And a slight variant on that is there are companies. I'll name one as an example: Netskope, which are in the business of enterprises protecting exfiltration, that's the story anyway, where they effectively man in the middle almost all connections in a way with like 1.2 that says, oh, you're going to a site that we believe is genuine and fine, we'll just get out of the way and let it go, which I don't believe is possible in 1.3, And I'm curious whether we're going to see a fork of the folks that do 1.2 so they can do middleware or things like that, where they're going to lie, and whether certificates are going to somehow know whether they're really going to be a 1.3 only shop and things like that. It's just an interesting, can you know whether you're really genuine or whether you're being spoofed as far as the trust anchors that you're using?
Yeah, so let's try not to be political here. So one of the things 1.3 did is it got rid of using, you could still do it with TLS 1.2, but you got rid of using the static the server's RSA key to do the key exchange, which meant in 1.2, if you didn't turn on perfect forward secrecy, you could decrypt all of the traffic. And that's a big industry, and it's used a great deal in banks, and banks have a lot of money, all of our money, for example, access to it. And so they came late in the game and said, no, we understand you can't use TLS 1.3, but how are we going to intercept all of the traffic in our data center now? And the long-haired radicals at the IETF said, you can't. And they go, no, we spent millions on this infrastructure. What are we going to do? And we said, okay, you can't. So it's interesting from a protocol side that, you know, real money is involved, and people who are used to getting their own way don't always get their own way. You're nodding. it's you have to tilt the playing field one way or another, as someone had said. And it's just it's not always just technology. There's real economics and real, you know, surveillance. The Snowden stuff made a lot of the technology protocol geeks working on TLS 1.3 and other things very suspicious. An industry that's doing intercepting man in the middle, great firewalls, is going to find it harder on 1.3.
Just to address some of the interoperability, how does that actually happen? Kind of backtracking just a little bit.
Yeah.
From our point of view, from LibreSSL's point of view, we do 6-month releases and we have support, so just 1 year. But also being integrated into an operating system means that every 6 months we get a new major release out, and it's immediately being used in people's mail servers. It's interoperating with web apps. It's interoperating with all kinds of things as part of the base of an operating system, and actually 3 or 4 operating systems now. And so we get that immediate feedback. Again, the live testing, which you may not have been able to do years ago, now it's like every 6 months we get feedback on how well does this interoperate? Did you break some old thing? Is there some weird mail gateway, iron port, that is having problems with your SSL implementation? Or is it time to finally kill that weird backward compatibility thing? And we get a lot of feedback from people all the time, but usually it's at 6 months intervals.
A quick question going back to the thing with the banks and the interception. I agree that man in the middle, my personal opinion, is a bad idea. I'm a consultant. I'm like, hey, don't, why would you do that? Let's find a different approach. At the same time, one of the things that I worry about is when you lock down security too much, people find ways around it, which are often worse, right? Like if you make them change their password every day, right, they end up using combinations that are worse, right? Do you think it's possible that by disabling or making it difficult to do the interception, that it could actually go to something worse? Like maybe people don't migrate away from 1.2 as quickly as they should, or that it opens the doors for some other kind of challenge. And I guess the follow-up question to that is there a way to, the reason why companies want to be able to scan traffic is, some of it's more nefarious, but at least some of it is to be able to check for threats coming in, which is becoming harder as we're moving to an all TLS type internet. Is there some solution on the horizon that is not as terrible as man in the middle, that enables, you know, the ability to scan some of the traffic at edges.
I can certainly think of a lot of more terrible ways to do it, for sure. I mean, I work on offensive security tools, so we build things that can inject into processes and can intercept all your socket traffic right at the socket layer. We build things that that sort of spoof your security, that basically can take over your whole machine, run inside the kernel, sniff all your sockets. I don't think you want that in your banking accounts, though. I really don't. That's all I can say about that.
What it does say, though, is that there's probably room out there for a new product, really. If it's an issue for the banks to be using TLS 1.3, there's just room for somebody to develop a new product to help them solve that particular issue in a manner that actually makes sense for the protocol.
Are you thinking like a special banking cipher suite that's insecure?
Actually, I think that would be a great option to offer first, because that would actually get the message across properly, and then we could have a more mature adult discussion about, okay, let's try and see what problem you're really trying to solve.
Mm-hmm. Bring back the null cipher.
Yeah, what do they need to do that needed to decrypt all the traffic?
Exactly. We have a pull request. It was written on April 1st, I think, that implemented the Caesar cipher. Complete. There was documentation. It did all, you know, all of the, followed all the code and style. And
yeah, it followed the coding style. It was commented.
Yeah,
it was very met well all the review criteria apart from being secure.
Yeah, and it probably only it allowed you to have a variation of whether you rotated it by, you know, 13 or 14.
Well, that was the parameter. Yeah, it was how long the shift was. And someone posted a comment that said, "Well, we really should have multiple shifts." But
so that's
key length,
good stuff.
A key length more than one.
Yeah,
just been secure against Visigoths and Carthaginians, of course.
Yeah, that's right. It would have kept the aqueducts running,
which is a major user base.
Yes, totally important today. I guess part of my point was probably not really understood in my question. My apology for not being clear. But a number of these products are actually putting up so that they intercept all the DNS traffic, they intercept all of the, you know, they basically throw up their own root CAs and everything else. And because enterprises are actually installing them in their enterprise, that's the root servers they trust. So it used to be the case that they could see, is this a traffic I care about? And if it isn't, then they could just let it through. And so they weren't watching your entire banking transaction if they believe that that's really what you're talking, the site you're talking to. But if you're talking to a site they weren't sure about, they'd see whether the traffic contained malware by doing deep packet inspection. And then as they were seeing that it looks like it's all clear traffic, they would drop it and let it continue on normally.
Sure.
But they would drop packets that were malware coming in, or the infections that were coming in, or if they see that someone's basically trying to stream out all of the source code of the proprietary project, they would drop it dead. And the problem is a matter of trust anchors, and I really meant trust anchors in the sense of, is there anything that we can do, if you want to be a privacy advocate, that stops that level of problem? And I know, I think we're going to see more of, well, we didn't really want to watch all the traffic, but now we have to, as the solution, which is a more draconian solution than letting them see some of the traffic early on if they're not allowing perfect forward security. That's the question.
Okay. So OpenSSL deliberately does not ship a set of trust anchors and CAs that are trusts. I just wonder what you guys do. Do you ship a...
Well, actually, LibreSSL does. We ship the same trust anchors that are packaged with OpenBSD in the first place. So it actually ships with that and installs it by default. Although, to be honest with you, a lot of that comes from Mozilla's. So it's kind of a transitive trust.
Yeah, we basically adopted the same approach. We don't ship anything. Although, if you are using our JSSE, then obviously you pick up the JVM trust anchors that have been installed as part of Java, just simply for compliance reasons. I'm pretty sure that's how people expect it to work.
Maybe a separate topic. The who do you trust and the trust anchors community is changing a lot. Google is driving certificate transparency into all sorts of platforms, so you can see what CAs have issued what certificates and whether or not you trust it. I think the minute you say enterprise, the whole world shifts. But I think also the world is shifting away from that to Google's Beyond Corp. And I forget what my CEO calls it, sadly. But the idea that there aren't firewalls, that everyone's directly on the net, and therefore, you know, an enterprise version of Chrome that has your man in the middle CA anchor is going to be less likely, you know, 3, 4, 5 years from now.
Well, wouldn't more widespread support of the evil bit fix this problem?
you laugh about that, but I've seen some interesting projects where people have actually signed all of their good flows and then looked for where the bad ones were based on the fact that they just weren't already sort of pre-approved. Changes at the TCP layer, like at kernel drivers and that sort of thing. Yeah. So I've seen projects that did things kind of conceptually like that, but they never really made it out of people's internal enterprises.
Anyway, I did have a serious question. What's wrong with TLS 1.3?
Oh, he's got an idea.
That's really open-ended for you.
Yeah, sure.
It's still in draft.
It's taken too long. No. So I have concerns about this stuff called zero RTT early data. One of the things TLS does is 1.3 does is it makes things faster by reducing the number of round trips. We're in the process of doing measurements to see what the net improvement is sort of on a global perspective. Akamai, not OpenSSL. And it'll help. It will certainly help in, you know, the developing world kind of places where networks tend to take, you know, round trips take longer. TLS 1.3 has this concept of zero RTT, which is sort of equivalent to, well, TCP fast open may not mean anything. If you've already spoken to a server, what you do is you collapse the layers and you push down application traffic into that first hello message. And you encrypt it using a key that you've done with that server before. So that it's not forward secrecy. And then the server responds and now you've got a forward secrecy connection. But that first packet of data can have, it can be sent to the multiple servers, repeated. If you've got a cluster of servers, it can be sent to all of them, repeating it. So therefore, you don't want to make it be a post. You want to make it be a get, right? But if that get is like this one guy said, you know, he had a get that toggled his garage door. And so every time somebody hit, you know, control R, his door opened and closed, right? Because it was just a get. It's safe to do get. So you have to be careful about using zero RTT from a semantic point of view because it can be replayed. And then you have to be careful from a security point of view because that data is not forward secrecy encrypted, and it's encrypted in a key that lasts longer, maybe 24 hours instead of just the connection. So the browsers are really, really pushing this. And some of the two main browsers, two most popular browsers, Chrome and Firefox, are really, really pushing this, and they don't distinguish between that data. They just sort of try zero RTT and then send the whole rest of the stream. Other companies are looking and saying, well, we have the RTT, and that's a separate API. And so understanding when that security boundary is crossed and what the potential implications and weaknesses are, for example, you would expect that, you know, H2 cookies would show up early in the message. And if those cookies link to login sessions and can be decrypted within 24 hours because it's a longer-term key, there'll probably be, as my colleague at work puts it, interesting discussions to be had. So that's my concern. The rest of it is all really cool. And getting one round trip out is good. Getting two round trips might be erring too much on the side of speed.
So, David, your viewpoint on TLS 1.3, it's perfect?
Actually, the only thing I'm aware of is what Rick's already talked about, which is the zero round trip stuff. Certainly, yeah, the fact it's simpler, the actual handshaking simpler, it's got to be a good thing. There's no other way of describing it. But I think the the implications of the zero RTT aren't fully understood at this point. Or actually, maybe I should put this the other way. The implications are understood, but the implications of how it's going to pan out as people implement it are not fully understood. Yeah.
So you'd see the changes between draft 26 and 28 helping with the elegant simplicity in TLS 1.3?
Yeah, there's no change.
Yes. Wouldn't argue.
Can you talk about zero RTT and implication on tracking and privacy?
So does zero RTT make the banking industry feel better?
It probably doesn't help the banks, but it does help track somehow. It's unclear if it's on the browser side or knowing who is talking to the server.
So do we have any of the vendors participating in TLS 1.3 very interested in tracking?
Not that I'm aware of. There are some vendors who have banks as their customers who have been present at the IETF meetings. That's a good way to, you know, publicly. Trying to make their customers happy, of course. Yeah, there might be some, there is definitely some impact. There's definitely more signal available. Interestingly, QUIC, this new protocol coming along, uses zero RTT. And zero RTT was put in TLS so that QUIC could use it. Otherwise, QUIC was going to develop its own crypto. TLS is, as David had said, and TLS 1.3 is a really nice, clean, elegant protocol. If you were going to start from scratch and didn't have a 1.1, 1.2 protocol implementation, it would be the way to go. It's hard to retrofit it. I don't know what you guys' experience was. NSS, they said, oh, we shipped it off and did a whole new thing. Facebook, they look early on in the code, and right now they were using OpenSSL at one point, and then just for 1.3, they shifted off to their own code. They just complete separate implementation, basically.
So we've been focusing in on TLS 1.3, of course, because that's what everybody's interested in knowing, when, where, how, why. But the actual standards development process, I've got another one of the pre-canned questions up behind you. Do we get a lot of open source TLS implementation involvement in the actual specification development as distinct from just tracking it?
As the IETF guy. We certainly, NSS and OpenSSL are involved. We've also seen a couple of almost, I don't want to say single party individuals. The Go TLS people are there, are present. Somebody has written a TLS implementation in Haskell, and it's there as a Pico TLS. So that interop matrix you showed, many of them are open source, and they're not all medium to big projects. Because I think TLS 1.3 is easier to implement. There's one lone hacker in Japan, and he gets equal say in terms of the interop. If it doesn't work or he finds a bug, and he has found bugs, they get fixed and addressed. So it's been a really good thing, as opposed to people work in a room in a committee. You know, committee works in a room, and here's the standard. Now everyone goes implements it, and then they find the problems. And also, it's been cryptographers have looked at it from the beginning, which has also been very helpful.
So, David, what about your experiences?
Oh, we basically just tracked it, but yeah, I definitely say that the process from the protocol specification point of view is a lot more mature. You could tell that everyone had been around the merry-go-round a few times, and they felt like it was time to get off. But we were really just following it. I think for us, getting too heavily involved, aside from the odd email about something, really a resource issue. I think it's just that classic thing of being an open source project. You just don't have the time to get too heavily involved in these things. I don't know if I'd say that was a good thing, but it's just the way it is at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Brent, from a Libra perspective?
Yeah. So I would say traditionally, a lot of things that OpenBSD has pushed forward have been kind of in reverse. Rather than building a standard, then building a spec, then building an implementation, we sort of do a lot, just as a general approach, do more of an iterative type of model. When thinking of, like, say, other sort of security innovations that come from OpenBSD, like, for instance, the pledge system call, which has been under 2 years of development so far. But it's gone through a lot of iterations, and maybe backwards compatibility breaks every 6 months. We learn something new from the software ecosystem. When it comes to, say, participating in, like, standards bodies, I think to kind of echo your sentiment, a lot of it kind of comes down to time and resources and that sort of thing. I suspect that probably we'll end up figuring out when we go into TLS 1.3, looking at the standard, saying, all right, what do we see that looks safe to implement? What do we see that maybe we can just ignore or skip? Maybe zero RTT is something that we say, you know, actually we're not going to implement that, or we're going to implement it in a way that kind of has all the training wheels on in the first place, and that way you can't shoot yourself in the foot with it. So it's something where we'll probably, you know, end up picking and choosing what we want. Resources are always an interesting kind of constraint there. And I think probably more we're going to be more interested in just iterating and figuring out what works over time. Just the opposite approach, just sort of getting prototypes out there and testing them out. Mm-hmm. I would say also the Boring SSL project is a little bit of our sort of a... it's something we also look at feeds a lot into the project, and I'm pretty sure that we'll probably get a lot of input from them as far as how their TLS 1.3 implementation went out, because a lot of the state machine is the same between Libra SSL and Boring these days.
I'm curious what you guys do about ciphers. Mark, I think, had mentioned, we only need one, maybe two ciphers. I'm curious how you guys decide what to implement and provide.
Part of it's around, like, who's using it. For instance, we added, we for a while had Ghost and Camellia turned off, and then later on we had users that said, hey, actually we need Ghost. Someone from Ukraine actually implemented a lot of the Ghost ciphers for Libra SSL, re-implemented them without using engines. Same thing with Camellia as well. Someone re-implemented them without using engines. So I forget if those were engine-based or not in the first place. Ghost was. Yeah. But we were trying to avoid using engines because we didn't want all the function pointers and everything in this code base. Said, if someone really wants it, implement it, but do it as a standard cipher suite. And so that's how we ended up pulling that one in. Other things, like, for instance, thinking about speed or interoperability, things like that. X255-19, Cha-Cha-20, all those kind of things came in. A lot of times we were looking at Boring and saying, all right, this is a really nice patch. We get some extra speed benefits as well, especially on some of our weaker architectures. Being a project that also focuses on weird little ARM CPUs and VAX, for a while we had VAX machines and things like that. We were also thinking in terms of what's secure, but also can actually run within our hardware platforms that we have out there. AES-256 was killing Spark 32-bit system machines for a while, and so we killed them off. But that sort of also plays into what we end up supporting, is what we can do securely, but also fits within our ecosystem.
Yeah, in our case, we're kind of a cross-compatibility organization, so we generally add everything, unless there's something about a particular cipher suite which makes everyone suspect that you'd be insane to use it.
So the Caesar pull request should have been done against Bouncy Castle?
Again, we would have done a risk assessment on the Carthage Visigoth issue, and I suspect it would have been rejected politely, of course.
Politely,
I
mean,
you don't want to ruffle people's feathers unnecessarily. They're all trying to help. I don't think we would have accepted that. As an example, I mean, we're already talking about trying to add SM2 with SM3, the Chinese. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of proposed Chinese cipher suites. And we've already had requests around those as well.
So you're actually anticipating a growth in regional cipher usage in general, or is it entirely dependent on customer requests?
It's partly dependent on customer requests, because obviously if you're dealing with something like SM2 and SM3, you need something to test against. Mm-hmm. It's a Chinese national standard. My Mandarin's not very good. One of the nice things about a lot of crypto stuff, though, is even if you're actually reading a foreign language document, the maths always looks the same.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of one of the things that saves us. So it's sort of, it's generally customer driven. But the thing is, I think it's just because a lot of people have us in the middle of a number of organisations and national cipher suites. Obviously, everybody likes the one that they're using, that they've standardised, and Java is such a cross boundary sort of language.
Who likes it? Who likes national cipher suites? Is it the governments that know how to crack them all, or is it what sort of drives?
I don't know. I just honestly don't know. Taking China as an example, they have some national cipher suites that they're currently developing. When they're developed, then their banking system and government agencies will be using those to talk to the general public. The general public at that point who are writing applications talking to those things will need to be able to interop with those cipher suites. Yeah, it's not... I mean, with things like that, it's not like you go into the shop and go, oh, yeah, that's a nice one, I like the colours. You know, generally, you're using it because you're trying to speak a language to someone, really.
Right.
And the languages of government agencies, FIPS is another good example of this. The particular languages, if you want to look at the protocols in that sense, that government agencies actually dictate, they're the ones you need to use if you want to communicate with them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll stay away from anything else. We can talk about that later. But,
From a Libra perspective, you've got Russian cipher suites, but you won't do the American FIPS standard, and you're not thinking about adding the Chinese ones in?
I would say that no one's really discussed adding the Chinese ones in. It's just a matter of, has anyone contributed them? No. Pretty much people say, when are you going to implement this? When are you going to implement that? It's like, when someone has a need, when one of us has a need, when one of you sends us a patch, that's when we'll definitely implement it. People have been asking us for DTLS 1.2 support for a while.
Yeah,
and it's really close, right? And you're like, well, great, great. What program should I use to test this DTLS 1.2 support out? The question is there's sort of a chicken and egg sort of problem. We try not to implement things that we have no idea how people are going to use them, or even if they're going to use them. Just throwing the kitchen sink is definitely not a priority.
So kitchen sink, not the philosophy for OpenBSD in general. That's not a Libra SSL specific context.
Yeah, I would say delete first. Ask questions later.
That's good. Yeah, since you're talking about cipher suites, I was just thinking about the post-quantum. There's been a lot of talk about that and just how that plays into the TLS aspect as well, that there's going to be a transition and we're going to have to be ready.
Indeed. So across the three implementations we've got sitting here, what is your roadmap timetable for post-quantum algorithms in TLS?
We did actually get a working client using the protocol that Google, I think it was, put forward using New Hope.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so we experimented with that. Honestly, we don't see any problems, at least with the New Hope algorithm. If we had to add it quickly, we certainly could. Of course, our inclination would be to wait for someone to actually publish an extension for TLS as an RFC before running onto that one ourselves, though, because we have enough to kind of deal with just with what's published already.
So we're waiting on the TLS 1.3 working group?
Well, I was going to suggest Draft 29. But
Draft 29,
see, yeah. Rich was developing a tick, so I thought I'd...
Well, I would say outside of just TLS, we've been talking about TLS, but I guess this is more general crypto. Like OpenSSH already has post-quantum algorithms that it's shipping experimental in the latest releases. We're actually working on an internal crypto library that potentially Libre and OpenSSH can share to be able to share some of those other algorithms as well. So it's on our... I want to say we have a roadmap. It's an open source project. It's what people actually want to contribute. But it's definitely something that's in people's minds.
Yeah, on the OpenSSL side, we haven't formally decided, but it's probably a couple of years out. Right.
So we're hitting the last 5 minutes of the panel. So if anybody's got any burning questions, they've been saving to the end to keep the panelists on their toes. Now is the time to bring them forward. No burning questions.
People need their coffee.
Okay, well, we'll go to another pre-canned topic. Open source, good or bad?
When you're Spider-Man. Downloading open source software, you're downloading communism. What can I say? I think especially for this particular area, as in cryptography and security, I think really it's the only answer. I don't agree with the idea that just because you publish the code, people are going to deliberately look in it to find bugs. But we do actually find that people do look in it and find bugs. And we actually had one recently found in an RSA key pair generator, which at the particular piece of code had been reviewed independently by probably 6, maybe 7 testing labs. It had been certified by NIST maybe 20 times. And I swear if it was a closed source implementation 10 years from now, I probably would have been sitting there looking at it going, oh, actually that's wrong. Mm-hmm. It was just some guy in England was bored and he wanted to understand how the RSA key generation worked. Yeah, and he picked it up. So, I mean, if that was a closed source implementation, that flaw, I mean, it's not a severe defect, but that flaw never would have been found. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would say definitely open. From my experience, I've worked on both open and closed source crypto projects, and the open source ones are still around. The closed source ones are dead in a closet. So, at least from a general, make me feel better point of view, I love being able to pull forward code that I've written in other engagements. I love being able to, contribute and have people look at the things that we've done and improve them as well. Working with an over 20-year-old open source project is also, I think it's worked well for us.
So OpenSSL is probably the poster child about talking about the risks in that it can get moribund, but we're not now. The whole community is engaged in not just OpenSSL, but, with Libra and Boring and the 7,000 forks and so on. So, there's no guarantee that it's better, but the tooling is getting better. The supporting infrastructure for, CI builds and validated crypto from Galois and things like that just aren't feasible on a closed source scale, I think. It's also no surprise that all the, many of the big internet companies, right, they have a very active and vibrant open source engagement and involvement.
So how do you handle the question, Rich and Brent, in terms of, C is inherently unsafe and everything should be written in Java or C#?
Sure. Let's start by rewriting the applications. It's not the best language. Languages have gotten better. But it's got a good trade-off for, it's got lots of sharp edges, but there's a good trade-off for efficiency and size.
I would say the tooling has improved considerably over the past few years. Having actual competition in compilers has been a really great thing at LLVM versus GCC. That diversity there, that's one place where, do we need one compiler or do we need a dozen compilers? I would say a dozen because every compiler finds new bugs. Every compiler finds new edge cases. Do we need one CPU? Should everything be x86-64 or do we need a diversity? Diversity finds bugs. I think that... I forgot what the question was.
Does Java suck?
What's that? C, yeah, exactly. So, I kind of agree C does have sharp edges, but I think that some of the things that you do to make C safer are things that actually make all languages safer, whether it's, ASLR, whether it's, randomization, whether it's stack protection, all those kind of things are things that aren't just C-specific fixes. And I think that there are definitely things that we've done over the past, few decades that have made all this work a lot better.
Well, I guess I'm clearly not in a position to comment on anyone else's C code at this point. Although, originally I was a C programmer for about 12 years. I think the only point I'd probably say is actually, at the end of the day, you can write really bad code in any language. And I've certainly seen people do that. In fact, occasionally I've done it myself. I don't think C itself is a defect using it. And I certainly think for resource-constrained environments where you're trying to write something the smallest with the smallest footprint that you can, it's probably one of the best choices, even now.
Hey, thanks, David. So we're out of time for the panel. Hopefully you can join me in thanking Rich, Brent and David for being on this panel today. And we are now in the break.
Remember, the first subject we did at uni was Pascal, and then it was a couple of years. It was the second year I actually first got to write C code. And I think, this is fantastic.
I can see how computers work for real.
I'm in heaven. I'm in heaven.
You did good.
Oh, yeah. I really don't get to write enough for doing that.
Right, two. You need ChaCha and you need AES, right? Because if it's coming from a desktop, it's going to have the AES instructions. If it's on a phone, it's going to be ChaCha.
Yeah. Well, that depends. If you've got the next thing, whatever it is that follows, because no one wants to run an Intel processor because it has Spectre, then what do? Right? Yeah. Even ARM has...
even ARM, right.
No, ARM's got
AES.
Has the speculative...
Yeah. Right. And it's also got the AES implementation.
Yeah, so is there a correlation? I don't know.
The government cipher issues are really...
Right.
We need to do something, and I don't know what, about it. And it's got to come from both sides about restoring trust in our industry.
Sure.
Because having people like us arguing for the same, so when we are dealing with... I mean, one of the other things I do is run a college.
No, you can't do it. It's got the same message digest. So if someone is terminating an action, then they can do anything
they want.
If they're in the middle, they can't inject stuff.
I don't know what text we're seeing now.